Book 5, Chapter 1 of the Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by HearHis.com. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus. Translated by William Weston. Book 5. Containing the interval of near 6 months. From the coming of Titus to besiege Jerusalem, to the great extremity to which the Jews were reduced. Chapter 1. Concerning the seditions at Jerusalem, and what terrible miseries afflicted the city by their means. When therefore Titus had marched over that desert which lies between Egypt and Syria in the manner forementioned, he came to Caesarea, having resolved to set his forces in order at that place before he began the war. Nay, indeed, while he was assisting his father at Alexandria in settling that government which had been newly conferred upon them by God, it so happened that the sedition at Jerusalem was revived, and parted into three factions, and that one faction fought against the other, which partition in such evil cases may be said to be a good thing, and the effect of divine justice. Now, as to the attack the zealots made upon the people, and which I esteem the beginning of the city's destruction, it hath been already explained after an accurate manner, as also whence it arose, and to how great a mischief it was increased. But for the present sedition, one should not mistake if he called it a sedition begotten by another sedition, and to be like a wild beast grown mad, which, for want of food from abroad, fell now upon eating its own flesh. For Eleazar, the son of Simon, who made the first separation of the zealots from the people, and made them retire into the temple, appeared very angry at John's insolent attempts, which he made every day upon the people. For this man never left off murdering. But the truth was that he could not bear to submit to a tyrant who set up after him. So, he being desirous of gaining the entire power and dominion to himself, revolted from John, and took to his assistance Judas the son of Selchiuses, and Simon the son of Ezron, who were among the men of greatest power. There was also with him Hezekiah the son of Chobar, a person of eminence. Each of these were followed by a great many of the zealots. These seized upon the inner court of the temple, and laid their arms upon the holy gates, and over the holy fronts of that court. Footnote: this appears to be the first time that the zealots ventured to pollute this most sacred court of the temple, which was the court of the priests, wherein the temple itself and the altar stood. So that the conjecture of those that would interpret that Zacharias, who was slain, quote, between the temple and the altar several months before, as if he were slain there by these zealots, is groundless, as I had noted on that place already. End footnote. And because they had plenty of provisions, they were of good courage, for there was a great abundance of what was consecrated to sacred uses, and they scrupled not the making use of them. Yet were they afraid on account of their small number, and when they had laid up their arms there, they did not stir from the place they were in. Now as to John, what advantage he had above Eleazar in the multitude of his followers, the like disadvantage he had in the situation he was in, since he had his enemies over his head, and as he could not make any assault upon them without some terror, so was his anger too great to let them be at rest. Nay, although he suffered more mischief from Eleazar and his party than he could inflict upon them, yet would he not leave off assaulting them, insomuch that there were continual sallies made one against the other, as well as darts thrown at one another, and the temple was defiled everywhere with murders. But now the tyrant Simon, the son of Gorias, whom the people had invited in, out of the hopes they had of his assistance in the great distresses they were in, having in his power the upper city, and a great part of the lower, did now make more vehement assaults upon John and his party, because they were fought against from above also, yet was he beneath their situation when he attacked them, as they were beneath the attacks of the others above them. Whereby it came to pass that John did both receive and inflict great damage, and that easily, as he was fought against on both sides, and the same advantage that Eleazar and his party had over him, since he was beneath them, the same advantage that he, by his higher situation, over Simon. On which account he easily repelled the attacks that were made from beneath by the weapons thrown from their hands only, but he was obliged to repel those that threw their darts from the temple above him by his engines of war, for he had such engines as threw darts and javelins and stones, and that in no small number, by which he did not only defend himself from such as fought against him, but slew moreover many of the priests, as they were about their sacred ministrations. For notwithstanding these men were mad with all sorts of impiety, yet did they still admit those that desired to offer their sacrifices, although they took care to search the people of their own country beforehand, and both suspected and watched them, while they were not so much afraid of strangers, who, although they had gotten leave of them, how cruel soever they were to come into that court, were yet often destroyed by this sedition. For those darts that were thrown by the engines came with that force, that they went over all the buildings, and reached as far as the altar, and the temple itself, and fell upon the priests, and those that were about the sacred offices. Footnote: the Levites. End footnote. Insomuch that many persons who came thither with great zeal from the ends of the earth to offer sacrifices at this celebrated place, which was esteemed holy by all mankind, fell down before their own sacrifices themselves, and sprinkled that altar, which was venerable among all men, both Greeks and barbarians, with their own blood, till the dead bodies of strangers were mingled together with those of their own country, and those of profane persons with those of the priests, and the blood of all sorts of dead carcasses stood in lakes in the holy courts themselves. And now, O most wretched city, what misery so great as this dost thou suffer from the Romans when they came to purify thee from thine intestine hatred? For thou couldst be no longer a place fit for God, nor couldst thou long continue in being, after thou hadst been a sepulchre for the bodies of thine own people, and hadst made the holy house itself a burying place in this civil war of thine. Yet mayst thou again grow better, if perchance thou wilt hereafter appease the anger of that God who is the author of thy destruction. But I must restrain myself from these passions by the rules of history, since this is not a proper time for domestical lamentations, but for historical narrations. I therefore return to the operations that follow in this sedition. Footnote: this is an excellent reflection of Josephus, including his hopes of the restoration of the Jews upon their repentance, which is the grand, quote, hope of Israel, as Manasseh ben Israel, the famous Jewish rabbi, styles it in his small but remarkable treatise of that subject, of which the Jewish prophets are everywhere full. See the principal of those prophecies collected together at the end of the essay on the Revelation. End footnote. And now there were three treacherous factions in the city, the one parted from the other. Eleazar and his party that kept the sacred first fruits came against John in their cups, those that were with John plundered the populace, and went out with zeal against Simon. This Simon had his supply of provisions from the city, in opposition to the seditious. When, therefore, John was assaulted on both sides, he made his men turn about, throwing his darts upon those citizens that came up against him, from the cloisters he had in his possession, while he opposed those that attacked him from the temple by his engines of war. And if at any time he was freed from those that were above him, which happened frequently, from their being drunk and tired, he sallied out with a great number upon Simon and his party, and this he did always in such parts of the city as he could come at, till he set on fire those houses that were full of corn and of all other provisions. Footnote. This destruction of such a vast quantity of corn and other provisions, as was sufficient for many years, was the direct occasion of that terrible famine, which consumed an incredible number of Jews in Jerusalem during its siege. Nor, probably, could the Romans have taken this city, after all, had not these seditious Jews been so infatuated and thus madly to destroy what Josephus here justly styles, quote, the nerves of their power. In footnote. The same thing was done by Simon when, upon the others' retreat, he attacked the city also, as if they had on purpose done it to serve the Romans by destroying what the city had laid up against the siege, and by thus cutting off the nerves of their own power. Accordingly, it so came to pass that all the places that were about the temple were burnt down, and were become an intermediate desert space, ready for fighting on both sides of it, and that almost all that corn was burnt, which would have been sufficient for a siege of many years, so they were taken by the means of the famine, which it was impossible that they should have been, unless they had thus prepared the way for it by this procedure. And now, as the city was engaged in war on all sides, from those treacherous crowds of wicked men, the people of the city, between them, were like a great body torn in pieces. The aged men and their women were in such distress by their internal calamities that they wished for the Romans and earnestly hoped for the external war in order to their delivery from the domestical miseries. The citizens themselves were under a terrible consternation and fear, nor had they any opportunity of taking counsel and of changing their conduct, nor were there any hopes of coming to an agreement with their enemies, nor could such as had a mind flee away, for guards were set in all places, and the heads of the robbers, although they were seditious one against another in many respects, yet did they agree in killing those that were for peace with the Romans, or were suspected of an inclination to desert them as their common enemies. They agreed in nothing but this, to kill those that were innocent. The noise also of those that were fighting was incessant, both by day and by night. But the lamentations of those that mourned exceeded the other, nor was there ever any occasion for them to leave off their lamentations, because their calamities came perpetually one upon the other, although the deep consternation they were in prevented their outward wailing. But being constrained by their fear to conceal their inward passions, they were inwardly tormented, without daring to open their lips in groans. Nor was any regard paid to those that were still alive by their relations, nor was there any care taken to bury for those that were dead. The occasion of both, which was this, that every one despaired of himself, for those that were not among the seditious had no great desires of anything, as expecting for certain that they should very soon be destroyed. But for the seditious themselves, they fought against each other, while they trod upon the dead bodies as they lay heaped one upon another, and taking up a mad rage from those dead bodies that were under their feet, became the fiercer thereupon. They, moreover, were still inventing somewhat or other that was pernicious against themselves. And when they had resolved upon anything, they executed it without mercy, and omitted no method of torment or of barbarity. Nay, John abused the sacred materials and employed them in the construction of his engines of war. For the people and the priest had formerly determined to support the temple and raise the holy house 20 cubits higher. Footnote. This timber, we see, was designed for the rebuilding of those 20 additional cubits of the holy house above the 100 which had fallen down some years before. End footnote. For King Agrippa had at a very great expense and with very great pains brought thither such materials as were proper for that purpose, being pieces of timber very well worth seeing, both for their straightness and their largeness. But the war coming on and interrupting the work, John had them cut and prepared for the building him towers. He, finding them long enough to oppose from, them those his adversaries that thought him from the temple that was above him. He also had them brought and erected behind the inner court over against the west end of the cloisters, where alone he could erect them, whereas the other sides of that court had so many steps as would not let them come nigh enough the cloisters. Thus did John hope to be too hard for his enemies by these engines constructed by his impiety. But God himself demonstrated that his pains would prove of no use to him, by bringing the Romans upon him, before he had reared any of his towers, for Titus, when he had gotten together part of his forces about him, and had ordered the rest to meet him at Jerusalem, marched out of Caesarea. He had with him those 3 legions that had accompanied his father when he had laid Judea waste, together with that 12th legion which had been formerly beaten by Cestius, which legion, as it was otherwise remarkable for its valor, so did it march on now with greater alacrity to avenge themselves on the Jews, as remembering what they had formerly suffered from them. Of these legions he ordered the 5th to meet him by going through Emmaus, and the 10th to go up by Jericho. He also moved himself, together with the rest besides them, marched those auxiliaries that came from the kings, being now more in number than before, together with a considerable number that had come to his assistance from Syria, those also that had been selected out of these 4 legions and sent with them Mecaenas to Italy, had their places filled up out of these soldiers that came out of Egypt with Titus, who were 2,000 men chosen out of the armies of Alexandria. There followed him also 3,000 drawn from those that guarded the river Euphrates, and also there came Tiberius Alexander, who was a friend of his, most valuable, both for his goodwill to him and for his prudence. He had formerly been governor of Alexandria, but was now thought worthy to be general of the army under Titus. The reason of this was that he had been the first who encouraged Vespasian very lately to accept this his new dominion, and joined himself to him with great fidelity, when things were uncertain and fortune had not yet declared for him. He also followed Titus as a counselor, very useful to him in this war, both by his age and skill in such affairs. End of Book 5, Chapter 1. Recording by HearHis.com.
Book 5, Chapter 5 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Wars of the Jews, by Josephus, translated by William Whiston. Chapter 5, A Description of the Temple. 1. Now this temple, as I have already said, was built upon a strong hill. At first, the plain at the top was hardly sufficient for the holy house and the altar, for the ground about it was very uneven and like a precipice. But when King Solomon, who was the person that built the temple, had built a wall to it on its east side, there was then added one cloister founded on a bank cast up for it, and on the other parts the holy house stood naked. But in future ages the people added new banks, and the hill became a larger plain. Footnote. See the description of the temples hereto belonging, chapter 15. But note that what Josephus here says of the original scantiness of this Mount Moriah, that it was quite too little for the temple, and that at first it held only one cloister or court of Solomon's temple, and that the foundations were forced to be added long afterwards by degrees, to render it capable of the cloisters for the other courts, etc., is without all foundation in the Scriptures, and not at all confirmed by his exacter account in the Antiquities. All that is or can be true here is this, that when the court of the Gentiles was long afterward to be encompassed with cloisters, the southern foundation for these cloisters was found not to be large or firm enough, and was raised, and that additional foundation supported by great pillars and arches underground, which Josephus speaks of elsewhere, and which Mr. Moundrell saw, and describes, as extant underground at this day. And footnote. They then broke down the wall on the north side, and took in as much as sufficed afterward for the compass of the entire building. And when they had built walls on three sides of the temple round about, from the bottom of the hill, and had performed a work that was greater than could be hoped for, in which work long ages were spent by them, as well as all their sacred treasures were exhausted, which were still replenished by those tributes which were sent to God from the whole habitable earth. They then encompassed the upper parts with cloisters, as well as they afterward did the lowest court of the temple. The lowest part of this was erected to a height of 300 cubits, and in some places more. Yet did not the entire depth of the foundations appear, for they brought earth and filled up the valleys, as being desirous to make them on a level with the narrow streets of the city, wherein they made use of stones of 40 cubits in magnitude, for the great plenty of money they then had, and the liberality of the people, made this attempt of theirs to succeed to an incredible degree. And what could not be so much as hoped for as ever to be accomplished was, by perseverance and length of time, brought to perfection. 2. Now, for the works that were above these foundations, these were not unworthy of such foundations, for all the cloisters were double, and the pillars to them belonging were 25 cubits in height, and supported the cloisters. These pillars were of one entire stone, each of them, and that stone was white marble, and the roofs were adorned with cedar, curiously graven. The natural magnificence, the excellent polish, and the harmony of the joints in these cloisters afforded a prospect that was very remarkable, nor was it on the outside adorned with any work of the painter or engraver. The cloisters of the outmost court were in breadth 30 cubits, while the entire compass of it was by measure 6 furlongs, including the Tower of Antonia. Those entire courts that were exposed to the air were laid with stones of all sorts. When you go through these first cloisters, unto the second court of the temple, there was a partition made of stone all around, whose height was 3 cubits. Its construction was very elegant. Upon it stood pillars, at equal distance from one another, declaring the law of purity, some in Greek, and some in Roman letters, that, quote, no foreigner should go within that sanctuary, close quote. For that second court of the temple was called the sanctuary, and was ascended to by 14 steps from the first court. This court was 4 square, and had a wall about it peculiar to itself. The height of its buildings, although it were on the outside 40 cubits, was hidden by the steps, and on the inside that height was but 25 cubits. Footnote. What Josephus seems here to mean is this, that these pillars, supporting the cloisters in the second court, had their foundations, or lowest parts, as deep as the floor of the first or lowest court, but that so far of those lowest parts as were equal to the elevation of the upper floor above the lowest were, and must be, hidden on the inside by the ground or rock itself, on which that upper court was built, so that 40 cubits visible below were reduced to 25 visible above, and implies the difference of their height to be 15 cubits. The main difficulty lies here, how 14 or 15 steps should give an ascent of 15 cubits, half a cubit seeming sufficient for a single step. Possibly there were 14 or 15 steps at the partition wall, and 14 or 15 more thence into the court itself, which would bring the whole near to the just proportion. End footnote. For it being built over against a higher part of the hill with steps, it was no further to be entirely discerned within, being covered by the hill itself. Beyond these 13 steps, there was a distance of 10 cubits. This was all plain, whence there were other steps, each 5 cubits apiece, that led to the gates, which gates on the north and south sides were 8, on each of those sides 4, and of necessity 2 on the east. For since there was a partition built for the women on that side, as the proper place wherein they were to worship, there was a necessity for a second gate for them. This gate was cut out of its wall, over against the first gate. There was also on the other sides one southern and one northern gate, through which was a passage into the court of the women. For as to the other gates, the women were not allowed to pass through them, nor when they went through their own gate could they go beyond their own wall. This place was allotted to the women of our own country, and of other countries, provided they were of the same nation, and that equally. The western part of this court had no gate at all, but the wall was built entire on that side. But then the cloisters which were betwixt the gates extended from the wall inward, before the chambers, for they were supported by very fine and large pillars. These cloisters were single, and, excepting their magnitude, were in no way inferior to those of the lower court. 3. Now 9 of these gates were on every side covered over with gold and silver, as were the jambs of the doors and their lintels. But there was one gate that was without the inward court of the holy house, which was of Corinthian brass, and greatly excelled those that were only covered over with silver and gold. Each gate had 2 doors, whose height was severally 30 cubits, and their breadth 15. However, they had large spaces within of 30 cubits, and had on each side rooms, and those, both in breadth and in length, built like towers, and their height was above 40 cubits. 2 pillars did also support these rooms, and were in circumference 12 cubits. Now the magnitudes of the other gates were equal one to another, but that over the Corinthian gate, which opened on the east over against the gate of the holy house itself, was much larger, for its height was 50 cubits, and its doors were 40 cubits, and it was adorned after a most costly manner, as having much richer and thicker plates of silver and gold upon them than the other. These 9 gates had that silver and gold poured upon them by Alexander, the father of Tiberius. Now there were 15 steps which led away from the wall of the court of the women to this greater gate, whereas those that led thither from the other gates were 5 steps shorter. 4. As to the holy house itself, which was placed in the midst of the inmost court, that most sacred part of the temple, it was ascended to by 12 steps, and in front its height and its breadth were equal, and each 100 cubits, though it was behind 40 cubits narrower, for on its front it had what may be styled shoulders on each side, that passed 20 cubits further. Its first gate was 70 cubits high, and 25 cubits broad, but this gate had no doors, for it represented the universal visibility of heaven, and that it cannot be excluded from any place. Its front was covered with gold all over, and through it the first part of the house, that was more inward, did all of it appear, which, as it was very large, so did all the parts about the more inward gate appear to shine to those that saw them. But then, as the entire house was divided into two parts within, it was only the first part of it that was open to our view. Its height extended all along to 90 cubits in height, and its length was 50 cubits, and its breadth 20. But that gate which was at this end of the first part of the house was, as we have already observed, all over covered with gold, as was its whole wall about it. It had also golden vines above it, from which clusters of grapes hung as tall as a man's height. But then this house, as it was divided into two parts, the inner part was lower than the appearance of the outer, and had golden doors of 55 cubits altitude, and 16 in breadth. But before these doors there was a veil of equal largeness within the doors. It was a Babylonian curtain, embroidered with blue, and fine linen, and scarlet, and purple, and of a contexture that was truly wonderful. Nor was this mixture of colors without its mystical interpretation, but was a kind of image of the universe. For by the scarlet there seemed to be enigmatically signified fire, by the fine flax, the earth, by the blue, the air, and by the purple, the sea, two of them having the colors the foundation of this resemblance. But the fine flax and the purple have their own origin for that foundation, the earth producing the one, and the sea the other. This curtain had also embroidered upon it all that was mystical in the heavens, excepting that of the 12 signs representing living creatures. 5. When any persons entered into the temple, its floor received them. This part of the temple, therefore, was in height 60 cubits, and its length the same, whereas its breadth was but 20 cubits. But still that 60 cubits in length was divided again, and the first part of it was cut off at 40 cubits, and had in it 3 things that were very wonderful and famous among all mankind: the candlestick, the table of showbread, and the altar of incense. Now the 7 lamps signified the 7 planets, for so many there were springing out of the candlestick. Now the 12 loaves that were upon the table signified the circle of the zodiac and the year. But the altar of incense, by its 13 kinds of sweet-smelling spices with which the sea replenished it, signified that God is the possessor of all things that are both in the uninhabitable and habitable parts of the earth, and that they are all to be dedicated to his use. But the inmost part of the temple of all was of 20 cubits. This was also separated from the outer part by a veil. In this there was nothing at all. It was inaccessible and inviolable, and not to be seen by any, and was called the Holy of Holies. Now about the sides of the lower part of the temple there were little houses, with passages out of one into another. There were a great many of them, and they were of 3 stories high. There were also entrances on each side into them from the gate of the temple. But the superior part of the temple had no such little houses any further, because the temple was there narrower, and 40 cubits higher, and of a smaller body than the lower parts of it. Thus we collect that the whole height, including the 60 cubits from the floor, amounted to 100 cubits. 6. Now the outward face of the temple in its front wanted nothing that was likely to surprise either men's minds or their eyes, for it was covered all over with plates of gold of great weight, and, at the first rising of the sun, reflected back a very fiery splendor, and made those who forced themselves to look upon it to turn their eyes away, just as they would have done at the sun's own rays. But this temple appeared to strangers, when they were coming to it at a distance, like a mountain covered with snow, for as to those parts of it that were not gilt, they were exceeding white. On its top it had spikes with sharp points to prevent any pollution of it by birds sitting upon it. Of its stones, some of them were 45 cubits in length, 5 in height, and 6 in breadth. Before this temple stood the altar, 15 cubits high, and equal both in length and breadth, each of which dimensions was 50 cubits. The figure it was built in was a square, and it had corners like horns, and the passage up to it was by an insensible acclivity. It was formed without any iron tool, nor did any such iron tool so much as touch it at any time. There was also a wall of partition, about a cubit in height, made of fine stones, and so as to be grateful to the sight. This encompassed the holy house and the altar, and kept the people that were on the outside off from the priests. Moreover, those that had the gonorrhea and the leprosy were excluded out of the city entirely. Women also, when their courses were upon them, were shut out of the temple. Nor, when they were free from that impurity, were they allowed to go beyond the limit before mentioned. Men also, that were not thoroughly pure, were prohibited to come into the inner court of the temple. Nay, the priests themselves that were not pure were prohibited to come into it also. 7. Now all those of the stock of the priests that could not minister by reason of some defect in their bodies came within the partition, together with those that had no such imperfection, and had their share with them by reason of their stock, but still made use of none except their own private garments, for nobody but he that officiated had on his sacred garments. But then those priests that were without any blemish upon them went up to the altar, clothed in fine linen. They abstained chiefly from wine, out of this fear, lest otherwise they should transgress some rules of their ministration. The high priest did also go up with them, not always indeed, but on the 7th days and new moons, and if any festivals belonging to our nation, which we celebrate every year, happened. When he officiated, he had on a pair of breeches that reached beneath his private parts to his thighs, and had on an inner garment of linen, together with a blue garment, round, without a seam, with fringe work, and reaching to the feet. There were also golden bells that hung upon the fringes, and pomegranates intermixed among them. The bells signified thunder, and the pomegranates lightning. But that girdle that tied the garment to the breast was embroidered with 5 rows of various colors, of gold and purple and scarlet, as also of fine linen and blue, with which colors we told you before the veils of the temple were embroidered also. The like embroidery was upon the ephod, but the quantity of gold therein was greater. Its figure was that of a stomacher for the breast. There were upon it 2 golden buttons, like small shields, which buttoned the ephod to the garment. In these buttons were enclosed 2 very large and very excellent sardonyxes, having the names of the tribes of that nation engraved upon them. On the other part were hung 12 stones, 3 in a row one way, and 4 in the other, a sardius, a topaz, and an emerald, a carbuncle, a jasper, and a sapphire, an agate, an amethyst, and a ligure, an onyx, a beryl, and a chrysolite, upon every one of which was again engraved one of the 4 mentioned names of the tribes. A mitre, also of fine linen, encompassed his head, which was tied by a blue ribbon, about which there was another golden crown, in which was engraven the sacred name of God. It consists of 4 vowels. However, the high priest did not wear these garments at other times, but a more plain habit. He only did it when he went into the most sacred part of the temple, which he did but once in a year, on that day when our custom is for all of us to keep a fast to God. and thus much concerning the city and the temple, but for the customs and laws hereto relating, we shall speak more accurately another time, for there remain a great many things thereto relating which have not been here touched upon. 8. Now as to the Tower of Antonia, it was situated at the corner of two cloisters of the court of the temple, of that on the west and that on the north. It was erected upon a rock of 50 cubits in height, and was on a great precipice. It was the work of King Herod, wherein he demonstrated his natural magnanimity. In the first place, the rock itself was covered over with smooth pieces of stone from its foundation, both for ornament, and that any one who would either try to get up or to go down to it might not be able to hold his feet upon it. Next to this, and before you come to the edifice of the tower itself, there was a wall 3 cubits high, but within that wall all the space of the Tower of Antonia itself was built upon, to the height of 40 cubits. The inward parts had the largeness and form of a palace, it being parted into all kinds of rooms and other conveniences, such as courts and places for bathing, and broad spaces for camps, insomuch that, by having all conveniences that cities wanted, it might seem to be composed of several cities, but by its magnificence it seemed a palace. And as the entire structure resembled that of a tower, it contained also 4 other distinct towers at its 4 corners, whereof the others were but 50 cubits high, whereas that which lay upon the southeast corner was 70 cubits high, that from thence the whole temple might be viewed. But on the corner where it joined to the 2 cloisters of the temple, it had passages down to them both, through which the guard, for there always lay in this tower a Roman legion, went several ways among the cloisters with their arms on the Jewish festivals, in order to watch the people, that they might not there attempt to make any innovations. For the temple was a fortress that guarded the city, and was the Tower of Antonia a guard to the temple, and in that tower were the guards of those 3. Footnote: these 3 guards that lay in the Tower of Antonia must be those that guarded the city, the temple, and the Tower of Antonia. And footnote: there was also a peculiar fortress belonging to the upper city, which was Herod's palace, but for the hill Bethesda it was divided from the Tower Antonia, as we have already told you, and as that hill on which the Tower of Antonia stood was the highest of these 3, so did it adjoin to the new city, and was the only place that hindered the sight of the temple on the north. And this shall suffice at present to have spoken about the city and the walls about it, because I have proposed to myself to make a more accurate description of it elsewhere. End of Book 5, Chapter 5.
Book 5, Chapter 6 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Morgan Scorpion. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Chapter 6. Concerning the tyrants Simon and John. How also, as Titus was going round the wall of this city, Nicanor was wounded by a dart, which accidentally provoked Titus to press on the siege. 1. Now the warlike men that were in the city, and the multitude of the seditious that were with Simon, were 10,000, besides the Idumeans. Those 10,000 had 50 commanders, over whom this Simon was supreme. The Idumeans that paid him homage were 5,000, and had 8 commanders, among whom those of greatest fame were Jacob, the son of Sosus, and Simon, the son of Cathlus. Jotra, who had seized upon the temple, had 6,000 armed men under 20 commanders. The zealots also that had come over to him and left off their opposition were 2,400, and had the same commander that they had formerly, Eleazar, together with Simon the son of Arenas. Now, while these factions fought one against another, the people were their prey on both sides, as we have said already, and that part of the people who would not join them in their wicked practices were plundered by both factions. Simon held the upper city, and the great wall as far as Kedron, and as much of the old wall as bent from Siloam to the east, and which went down to the palace of Monobazus, who was king of the Adiabeni, beyond Euphrates. He also held that fountain, and the Acra, which was no other than the lower city. He also held all that reached to the palace of Queen Helena, the mother of Monobazus. But John held the temple, and the parts thereto adjoining, for a great way, as also Ophla, and the valley called the Valley of Cedron. And when the parts that were interposed between their possessions were burnt by them, they left a space wherein they might fight with each other. For this internal sedition did not cease even when the Romans were encamped near their very wall. But although they had grown wiser at the first onset the Romans made upon them, this lasted but a while, for they returned to their former madness, and separated one from another, and fought it out, and did everything that the besiegers could desire them to do. For they never suffered anything that was worse from the Romans than they made each other suffer. Nor was there any misery endured by the city after these men's actions that could be esteemed new. But it was most of all unhappy before it was overthrown, while those that took it did a greater kindness, for I venture to affirm that the sedition destroyed the city, and the Romans destroyed the sedition, which it was a much harder thing to do than to destroy the walls, so that we may justly ascribe our misfortunes to our own people, and the just vengeance taken on them to the Romans, as to which matter let every one determine by the actions on both sides. 2. Now, when affairs within the city were in this posture, Titus went round the city on the outside with some chosen horsemen, and looked about for a proper place where he might make an impression upon the walls. But as he was in doubt where he could possibly make an attack on any side, for the place was no way accessible where the valleys were, and on the other side the first wall appeared too strong to be shaken by the engines, he thereupon thought it best to make his assault upon the monument of John the High Priest, for there it was that the first fortification was lower, and the second was not joined to it, the builders neglecting to build strong where the new city was not much inhabited. Here also was an easy passage to the third wall, through which he thought to take the upper part of the city, and through the Tower of Antonia, the temple itself. But at this time, as he was going round about the city, one of his friends, whose name was Nicanor, was wounded with a dart on his left shoulder, as he approached, together with Josephus, too near the wall, and attempted to discourse to those that were upon the wall about terms of peace, for he was a person known by them. On this account it was that Caesar, as soon as he knew their vehemence, that they would not hear even such as approached them to persuade them to what tended to their own preservation, was provoked to press on the siege. He also at the same time gave his soldiers leave to set the suburbs on fire, and ordered that they should bring timber together and raise banks against the city. And when he had parted his army into three parts, in order to set about those works, he placed those that shot darts and the archers in the midst of the banks that were then raising, before whom he placed those engines that threw javelins and darts and stones, that he might prevent the enemy from sallying out upon their works, and might hinder those that were upon the wall from being able to obstruct them. So the trees were now cut down immediately, and the suburbs left naked. But now, while the timber was carrying to raise the banks, and the whole army was earnestly engaged in their works, the Jews were not, however, quiet. And it happened that the people of Jerusalem, who had hitherto plundered and murdered, were now of good courage, and supposed they should have a breathing time, while the others were very busy in opposing their enemies without the city, and that they should now be avenged on those that had been the authors of their miseries, in case the Romans did but get the victory. 3. However, John stayed behind, out of his fear of Simon, even while his own men were earnest in making a sally upon their enemies without. Yet did not Simon lie still, for he lay near the place of the siege. He brought his engines of war, and disposed of them at due distances upon the wall, both those which they took from Cestius formerly, and those which they got when they seized the garrison that lay in the Tower Antonia. But though they had these engines in their possession, they had so little skill in using them, that they were in great measure useless to them. But a few there were who had been taught by deserters how to use them, which they did use, though after an awkward manner. So they cast stones and arrows at those that were making the banks. They also ran out upon them by companies, and fought with them. Now those that were at work covered themselves with hurdles spread over their banks, and their engines were opposed to them when they made their excursions. The engines, that all the legions had ready prepared for them, were admirably contrived, but still more extraordinary ones belonged to the 10th legion. Those that threw darts and those that threw stones were more forcible and larger than the rest, by which they not only repelled the excursions of the Jews, but drove those away that were upon the walls also. Now the stones that were cast were of the weight of a talent, and were carried 2 furlongs and further. The blow they gave was no way to be sustained, not only by those that stood first in the way, but by those that were beyond them for a great space. As for the Jews, they at first watched the coming of the stone, for it was of a white colour, and could therefore not only be perceived by the great noise it made, but could be seen also before it came by its brightness. Accordingly, the watchmen that sat upon the towers gave them notice when the engine was let go, and the stone came from it, and cried aloud in their own country language, "The stone cometh." So those that were in its way stood off, and threw themselves down upon the ground, by which means, and by their thus guarding themselves, the stone fell down and did them no harm. Footnote. What should be the meaning of this signal or watchword, when the watchman saw a stone coming from the engine, "The stone cometh," or what mistake there is in the reading, I cannot tell. The manuscripts, both Greek and Latin, all agree in this reading, and I cannot approve of any groundless conjectural alteration of the text from row to lop, that not the stone or a stone, but that the arrow or dart cometh, as hath been made by Dr. Hudson, and not corrected by Haverkamp. Had Josephus written even his first edition of these books of the war in pure Hebrew, or had the Jews then used the pure Hebrew at Jerusalem, the Hebrew word for a son is so like that for a stone, ben and eben, that such a correction might have been more easily admitted. But Josephus wrote his former edition for the use of the Jews beyond Euphrates, and so in the Chaldee language, as he did this second edition in the Greek language, and bar was the Chaldee word for son, instead of the Hebrew ben, and was used not only in Chaldea, etc., but in Judea also, as the New Testament informs us. Dio lets us know that the very Romans at Rome pronounced the name of Simon the son of Jorah, bar Porus, for bar Gioras, as we learn from Xiphiline. Welland takes notice that many will here look for a mystery, as though the meaning were that the Son of God came now to take vengeance on the sins of the Jewish nation, which is indeed the truth of the fact, but hardly what the Jews could now mean, unless possibly, by way of derision of Christ's threatening so often made, that he would come at the head of the Roman army for their destruction. But even this interpretation has but a very small degree of probability. If I were to make an emendation by mere conjecture, I would read instead of, "though the likeness be not so great as in low," because that is the word used by Josephus just before, as has already been noted on this very occasion, while "an arrow or dart" is only a poetical word, and never used by Josephus elsewhere, and is indeed no way suitable for the occasion, this engine not throwing arrows or darts, but great stones at this time. End footnote. But the Romans contrived how to prevent that by blacking the stone, who then could aim at them with success, when the stone was not discerned beforehand, as it had been till then, and so they destroyed many of them at one blow. Yet did not the Jews, under all this distress, permit the Romans to raise their banks in quiet, but they shrewdly and boldly exerted themselves, and repelled them both by night and by day. 4. And now, upon the finishing the Roman works, the workmen measured the distance there was from the wall, and this by lead and a line, which they threw to it from their banks, for they could not measure it any otherwise, because the Jews would shoot at them if they came to measure it themselves. And when they found that the engines could reach the wall, they brought them thither. Then did Titus set his engines at proper distances, so much nearer to the wall, that the Jews might not be able to repel them, and gave orders they should go to work. And when thereupon a prodigious noise echoed round about from 3 places, and that on the sudden there was a great noise made by the citizens that were within the city, and no less a terror fell upon the seditious themselves, whereupon both sorts, seeing the common danger they were in, contrived to make a like defence. So those of different factions cried out one to another, that they acted entirely as in concert with their enemies, whereas they ought, however, notwithstanding God did not grant them a lasting concord, in their present circumstances, to lay aside their enmities one against another, and to unite together against the Romans. Accordingly, Simon gave those that came from the temple leave, by proclamation, to go upon the wall. John also himself, though he could not believe Simon was in earnest, gave them the same leave. So on both sides they laid aside their hatred and their peculiar quarrels, and formed themselves into one body. They then ran round the walls, and having a vast number of torches with them, they threw them at the machines, and shot darts perpetually upon those that impelled those engines which battered the wall. Nay, the bolder sort leaped out by troops upon the hurdles that covered the machines, and pulled them to pieces, and fell upon those that belonged to them, and beat them, not so much by any skill they had, as principally by the boldness of their attacks. However, Titus himself still sent assistance to those that were the hardest set, and placed both horsemen and archers on the several sides of the engines, and thereby beat off those that brought the fire to them. He also thereby repelled those that shot stones or darts from the towers, and then set the engines to work in good earnest. Yet did not the wall yield to these blows, excepting where the battering ram of the 15th Legion moved the corner of a tower, while the wall itself continued unhurt, for the wall was not presently in the same danger with the tower, which was extant far above it, nor could the fall of that part of the tower easily break down any part of the wall itself together with it. 5. And now the Jews intermitted their sallies for a while, but when they observed the Romans dispersed all abroad at their works, and in their several camps, for they thought the Jews had retired out of weariness and fear, they all at once made a sally at the tower Hippicus, through an obscure gate, and at the same time brought fire to burn the works, and went boldly up to the Romans, and to their very fortifications themselves, where, at the cry they made, those that were near them came presently to their assistance, and those farther off came running after them. And here the boldness of the Jews was too hard for the good order of the Romans, and as they beat those whom they first fell upon, so they pressed upon those that were now gotten together. So this fight about the machines was very hot, while the one side tried hard to set them on fire, and the other side to prevent it. On both sides there was a confused cry made, and many of those in the forefront of the battle were slain. However, the Jews were now too hard for the Romans, by the furious assaults they made like madmen, and the fire caught hold of the works, and both all those works and the engines themselves had been in danger of being burnt, had not many of these select soldiers that came from Alexandria opposed themselves to prevent it, and had they not behaved themselves with greater courage than they themselves supposed they could have done, for they outdid those in this fight that had greater reputation than themselves before. This was the state of things till Caesar took the stoutest of his horsemen and attacked the enemy, while he himself slew 12 of those that were in the forefront of the Jews, which death of these men, when the rest of the multitude saw, they gave way, and he pursued them, and drove them all into the city, and saved the works from the fire. Now it happened at this fight that a certain Jew was taken alive, who by Titus's order was crucified before the wall, to see whether the rest of them would be affrighted, and abate of their obstinacy. But after the Jews were retired, John, who was the commander of the Idumeans, and was talking to a certain soldier of his acquaintance before the wall, was wounded by a dart shot at him by an Arabian, and died immediately, giving the greatest lamentation to the Jews, and sorrow to the seditious. For he was a man of great eminence, both for his actions and his conduct also. End of Book 5, Chapter 6.
Book 6, Chapter 1 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This recording is by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus, translated by William Whiston. Book 6, containing the interval of about 1 month, from the great extremity to which the Jews were reduced to the taking of Jerusalem by Titus. Chapter 1. That the misery still grew worse, and how the Romans made an assault upon the tower of Antonia. 1. Thus did the miseries of Jerusalem grow worse and worse every day, and the seditious were still more irritated by the calamities they were under, even while the famine preyed upon themselves, after it had preyed upon the people. And indeed the multitude of carcasses that lay in heaps one upon another was a horrible sight, and produced a pestilential stench, which was a hindrance to those that would make sallies out of the city, and fight the enemy. But as those were to go in battle array, who had been already used to 10,000 murders, and must tread upon those dead bodies as they marched along, so were not they terrified, nor did they pity men as they marched over them, nor did they deem this affront, offered to the deceased, to be any ill omen to themselves. But as they had their right hands already polluted with the murders of their own countrymen, and in that condition ran out to fight with foreigners, they seemed to me to have cast a reproach upon God himself, as if he were too slow in punishing them. For the war was not now gone on with as if they had any hope of victory, for they gloried after a brutish manner in that despair of deliverance they were already in. And now the Romans, although they were greatly distressed in getting together their materials, raised their banks in 1 and 20 days, after they had cut down all the trees that were in the country that adjoined to the city, and that for 90 furlongs round about, as I have already related. And truly the very view itself of the country was a melancholy thing, for those places which were before adorned with trees and pleasant gardens were now become a desolate country every way, and its trees were all cut down. Nor could any foreigner that had formerly seen Judea and the most beautiful suburbs of the city, and now saw it as a desert, but lament and mourn sadly at so great a change. For the war had laid all the signs of beauty quite waste. Nor if any one that had known the place before had come on a sudden to it now, would he have known it again. But though he were at the city itself, yet would he have inquired for it notwithstanding. 2. And now the banks were finished, they afforded a foundation for fear both to the Romans and to the Jews, for the Jews expected that the city would be taken, unless they could burn those banks, as did the Romans expect that, if these were once burnt down, they should never be able to take it. For there was a mighty scarcity of materials, and the bodies of the soldiers began to fail with such hard labors, as did their souls faint with so many instances of ill success. Nay, the very calamities themselves that were in the city proved a greater discouragement to the Romans than those within the city, for they found the fighting men of the Jews to be not at all mollified among such their sore afflictions, while they had themselves perpetually less and less hopes of success, and their banks were forced to yield to the stratagems of the enemy, their engines to the firmness of their wall, and their closest fights to the boldness of their attack. And, what was their greatest discouragement of all, they found the Jews' courageous souls to be superior to the multitude of the miseries they were under, by their sedition, their famine, and the war itself, insomuch that they were ready to imagine that the violence of their attacks was invincible, and that the alacrity they showed would not be discouraged by their calamities. For what would not those be able to bear, if they should be fortunate, who turned their very misfortunes to the improvement of their valor? These considerations made the Romans to keep a stronger guard about their banks than they had formerly had done. 3. But now John and his party took care for securing themselves afterward, even in case this wall should be thrown down, and fell to their work before the battering rams were brought against them. Yet did they not compass what they endeavored to do, but as they were gone out with their torches, they came back under great discouragement before they came near to the banks. And the reasons were these, that, in the first place, their conduct did not seem to be unanimous, but they went out in distinct parties, and at distinct intervals, and after a slow manner, and timorously, and, to say all in a word, without a Jewish courage. For they were now defective in what is peculiar to our nation, that is, in boldness, in violence of assault, and in running upon the enemy altogether, and in persevering in what they go about, though they do not at first succeed in it. But they now went out in a more languid manner than usual, and at the same time found the Romans set in array, and more courageous than ordinary, and that they guarded their banks both with their bodies and their entire armor, and this to such a degree on all sides that they left no room for the fire to get among them, and that every one of their souls was in such good courage that they would sooner die than desert their ranks. For besides their notion that all their hopes were cut off, in case these their works were once burnt, the soldiers were greatly ashamed that subtlety should be quite too hard for courage, madness for armor, multitude for skill, and Jews for Romans. The Romans had now also another advantage, in that their engines for sieges cooperated with them in throwing darts and stones as far as the Jews when they were coming out of the city, whereby the man that fell became an impediment to him that was next to him, as did the danger of going farther make them less zealous in their attempts. And for those that had run under the darts, some of them were terrified by the good order and closeness of the enemy's ranks before they came to a close fight, and others were pricked with their spears and turned back again. At length they reproached one another for their cowardice, and retired without doing anything. This attack was made upon the first day of the month Panemus, Tammuz. So when the Jews were retreated, the Romans brought their engines, although they had all the while stones thrown at them from the tower of Antonia, and were assaulted by fire and sword, and by all sorts of darts, which necessity afforded the Jews to make use of. For although these had great dependence on their own wall, and a contempt of the Roman engines, yet did they endeavour to hinder the Romans from bringing them. Now these Romans struggled hard, on the contrary, to bring them, as deeming that this zeal of the Jews was in order to avoid any impression to be made on the tower of Antonia, because its wall was but weak, and its foundations rotten. However, that tower did not yield to the blows given it from the engines, yet did the Romans bear the impressions made by the enemy's darts, which were perpetually cast at them, and did not give way to any of those dangers that came upon them from above, and so they brought their engines to bear. But then, as they were beneath the other, and were sadly wounded by the stones thrown down upon them, some of them threw their shields over their bodies, and partly with their hands, and partly with their bodies, and partly with crows they undermined its foundations, and with great pains they removed four of its stones. Then night came upon both sides, and put an end to this struggle for the present. However, that night the wall was so shaken by the battering rams in that place, where John had used his stratagem before, and had undermined their banks, that the ground then gave way, and the wall fell down suddenly. 4. When this accident had unexpectedly happened, the minds of both parties were variously affected, for though one would expect that the Jews would be discouraged, because this fall of their wall was unexpected by them, and they had made no provision in that case, yet did they pull up their courage, because the tower of Antonia itself was still standing, as was the unexpected joy of the Romans at this fall of the wall soon quenched by the sight they had of another wall, which John and his party had built within it. However, the attack of this second wall appeared to be easier than that of the former, because it seemed a thing of greater facility to get up to it through the parts of the former wall that were now thrown down. This new wall appeared also to be much weaker than the tower of Antonia, and accordingly the Romans imagined that it had been erected so much on the sudden that they should soon overthrow it. Yet did not anybody venture now to go up to this wall, for that such as first ventured so to do must certainly be killed. 5. And now, Titus, upon consideration that the alacrity of soldiers in war is chiefly excited by hopes and by good words, and that exhortations and promises do frequently make men to forget the hazards they run, nay, sometimes to despise death itself, got together the most courageous part of his army, and tried what he could do with his men by these methods. O fellow soldiers, said he, to make an exhortation to men to do what hath no peril in it, is on that very account inglorious to such to whom that exhortation is made. And indeed so it is in him that makes the exhortation, an argument of his own cowardice also. I therefore think that such exhortations ought then only to be made use of when affairs are in a dangerous condition, and yet are worthy of being attempted by every one themselves. Accordingly, I am fully of the same opinion with you, that it is a difficult task to go up this wall, but that it is proper for those that desire reputation for their valor to struggle with difficulties in such cases as will then appear, when I have particularly shown that it is a brave thing to die with glory, and that the courage here necessary shall not go unrewarded in those that first begin the attempt. And let my first argument to move you to it be taken from what probably some would think reasonable to dissuade you. I mean the constancy and patience of these Jews, even under their ill successes. For it is unbecoming you, who are Romans and my soldiers, who have in peace been taught how to make wars, and who have also been used to conquer in those wars, to be inferior to Jews, either in action of the hand or in courage of the soul, and this especially when you are at the conclusion of your victory and are assisted by God himself. For as to our misfortunes, they have been owing to the madness of the Jews, while their sufferings have been owing to your valor and to the assistance God hath afforded you. For as to the seditions they have been in, and the famine they are under, and the siege they now endure, and the fall of their walls without our engines, what can they all be but demonstrations of God's anger against them, and of his assistance afforded us? It will not therefore be proper for you, either to show yourselves inferior to those to whom you are really superior, or to betray that divine assistance which is afforded you. And indeed, how can it be esteemed otherwise than a base and unworthy thing, that while the Jews, who need not be much ashamed if they be deserted, because they have long learned to be slave to others, do yet despise death, that they may be so no longer, and do make sallies into the very midst of us frequently, not in hopes of conquering us, but merely for a demonstration of their courage? We, who have gotten possession of almost all the world that belongs to either land or sea, to whom it would be a great shame if we do not conquer them, do not at once undertake any attempt against our enemies, wherein there is much danger, but sit still idle, with such brave arms as we have, and only wait till the famine and fortune do our business themselves, and this when we have it in our power, with some small hazard, to gain all that we desire. For if we go up to this tower of Antonia, we gain the city. For if there should be any more occasion for fighting against those within the city, which I do not suppose there will, since we shall then be upon the top of the hill, and be upon our enemies before they can have taken breath, these advantages promise us no less than a certain and sudden victory. Footnote. Relland notes here very pertinently that the Tower of Antonia stood higher than the floor of the temple or court adjoining to it, and that accordingly they descended thence into the temple, as Josephus elsewhere speaks also. End of footnote. As for myself, I shall at present waive any commendation of those who die in war, and omit to speak of the immortality of those men who are slain in the midst of their martial bravery. Footnote. In this speech of Titus we may clearly see the notions which the Romans then had of death, and of the happy state of those who died bravely in war, and the contrary estate of those who died ignobly in their beds by sickness. Relland here also produces two parallel passages, the one out of Antonia Janus Marcellinus, concerning the Alani, that, quote, "they judged that man happy who laid down his life in battle," end quote. The other of Valerius Maximus, who says, quote, "that the Cimbri and Celtiberi exulted for joy in the army, as being to go out of the world gloriously and happily." End of quote. End of footnote. Yet cannot I forbear to imprecate upon those who are of contrary disposition, that they may die in time of peace, by some distemper or other, since their souls are condemned to the grave together with their bodies. For what man of virtue is there who does not know that those souls which are severed from their fleshly bodies in battles by the sword are received by the ether, that purest of elements, and joined to that company which are placed among the stars, that they become good demons and propitious heroes, and show themselves as such to their posterity afterwards? While upon those souls that wear away in and with their distempered bodies comes a subterranean night to dissolve them to nothing, and a deep oblivion to take away all the remembrance of them, and this notwithstanding they be clean from all spots and defilements of this world, so that, in this ease, the soul at the same time comes to the utmost bounds of its life, and of its body, and of its memorial also. But since he hath determined that death is to come of necessity upon all men, a sword is a better instrument for that purpose than any disease whatsoever. Why is it not then a very mean thing for us not to yield up that to the public benefit which we must yield up to fate? And this discourse have I made, upon the supposition that those who at first attempt to go upon this wall must needs be killed in the attempt, though still men of true courage have a chance to escape even in the most hazardous undertakings. For in the first place, that part of the former wall that is thrown down is easily to be ascended, and for the new-built wall it is easily destroyed. Do you, therefore, many of you, pull up your courage and set about this work, and do you mutually encourage and assist one another, and this your bravery will soon break the hearts of your enemies, and perhaps such a glorious undertaking as yours is may be accomplished without bloodshed. For although it is justly to be supposed that the Jews will try to hinder you at your first beginning to go up to them, yet when you have once concealed yourselves from them, and driven them away by force, they will not be able to sustain your efforts against them any longer, though but a few of you prevent them and get over the wall. As for that person who first mounts the wall, I should blush for shame if I did not make him to be envied of others by those rewards I would bestow upon him. If such a one escape with his life, he shall have the command of others that are now but his equals, although it be true also that the greatest rewards will accrue to such as die in the attempt. 6. Upon this speech of Titus, the rest of the multitude were affrighted at so great a danger. But there was one whose name was Sabinus, a soldier that served among the cohorts, an Assyrian by birth, who appeared to be of very great fortitude, both in the actions he had done and the courage of his soul he had shown, although anybody would have thought, before he came to his work, that he was of such a weak constitution of body that he was not fit to be a soldier. For his color was black, his flesh was lean and thin, and lay close together. But there was a certain heroic soul that dwelt in this small body, which body was indeed much too narrow for that peculiar courage which was in him. Accordingly he was the first that rose up when he thus spake, "I readily surrender up myself to thee, O Caesar. I first ascend the wall, and I heartily wish that my fortune may follow my courage and my resolution. And if some ill fortune grudge me the success of my undertaking, take notice that my ill success will not be unexpected, but that I choose death voluntarily for thy sake." When he had said this, and had spread out his shield over his head with his left hand, with his right hand drawn his sword, he marched up to the wall just about the sixth hour of the day. There followed him 11 others, and no more, that resolved to imitate his bravery. But still this was the principal person of them all, and went first, as excited by a divine fury. Now those that guarded the wall shot at them from thence, and cast innumerable darts upon them from every side. They also rolled very large stones upon them, which overthrew some of those 11 that were with him. But as for Sabinus himself, he met the darts that were cast at him, and though he was overwhelmed with them, yet did he not leave off the violence of his attack before he had gotten up on the top of the wall, and had put the enemy to flight. For as the Jews were astonished at his great strength, and the bravery of his soul, and as, withal, they imagined more of them had got upon the wall than really had, they were put to flight. And now one cannot but complain here of fortune, as still envious at virtue, and always hindering the performance of glorious achievements. This was the case of the man before us, when he had just obtained his purpose, for he then stumbled at a certain large stone, and fell down upon it headlong with a very great noise. Upon which the Jews turned back, and when they saw him to be alone, and fallen down also, they threw darts at him from every side. However, he got upon his knee, and covered himself with his shield, and at the first defended himself against them, and wounded many of those that came near him. But he was soon forced to relax his right hand, by the multitude of the wounds that had been given him, till at length he was quite covered over with darts before he gave up the ghost. He was one who deserved a better fate, by reason of his bravery, but, as might be expected, he fell under so vast an attempt. As for the rest of his partners, the Jews dashed three of them to pieces with stones, and slew them as they were gotten up to the top of the wall. The other eight, being wounded, were pulled down and carried back to the camp. These things were done upon the third day of the month Panemus, Tammuz. 7. Now 2 days afterward, 12 of those men that were on the forefront and kept watch upon the banks got together, and called to them the standard-bearer of the 5th legion, and 2 others of a troop of horsemen, and 1 trumpeter. These went without noise, about the 9th hour of the night, through the ruins to the tower of Antonia. And when they had cut the throats of the first guards of the place, as they were asleep, they got possession of the wall, and ordered the trumpeter to sound his trumpet. Upon which the rest of the guard got up on the sudden, and ran away, before anybody could see how many they were that had gotten up, for, partly from the fear they were in, and partly from the sound of the trumpet which they heard, they imagined a great number of the enemy were gotten up. But as soon as Caesar heard the signal, he ordered the army to put on their armor immediately, and come thither with his commanders, and first of all ascended, as did the chosen men that were with him. And as the Jews were flying away to the temple, they fell into that mine which John had dug under the Roman banks. Then did the seditious of both the bodies of the Jewish army, as well that belonging to John as that belonging to Simon, drive them away, and indeed were no way wanting as to the highest degree of force and alacrity, for they esteemed themselves entirely ruined if once the Romans got into the temple, as did the Romans look upon the same thing as the beginning of their entire conquest. So a terrible battle was fought at the entrance of the temple, while the Romans were forcing their way, in order to get possession of that temple, and the Jews were driving them back to the tower of Antonia, in which battle the darts were on both sides useless, as well as the spears, and both sides drew their swords and fought it out hand to hand. Now during the struggle, the positions of the men were undistinguished on both sides, and they fought at random, the men being intermixed one with another, and confounded by reason of the narrowness of the place, while the noise that was made fell on the ear after an indistinct manner, because it was so very loud. Great slaughter was now made on both sides, and the combatants trod upon the bodies and the armor of those that were dead, and dashed them to pieces. Accordingly, to which side soever the battle inclined, those that had the advantage exhorted one another to go on, as did those that were beaten make great lamentation. But still there was no room for flight, nor for pursuit, but disorderly revolutions and retreats, while the armies were intermixed one with another. But those that were in the first ranks were under the necessity of killing or being killed, without any way of escaping. For those on both sides that came behind forced those before them to go on, without leaving any space between the armies. At length the Jews' violent zeal was too hard for the Romans' skill, and the battle already inclined entirely that way, for the fight had lasted from the 9th hour of the night till the 7th hour of the day. While the Jews came on in crowds, and had the danger the temple was in for their motive, the Romans having no more here than a part of their army, for those legions, on which the soldiers on that side depended, were not come up to them. So it was at present thought sufficient by the Romans to take possession of the tower of Antonia. 8. But there was one Julian, a centurion, that came from Ithenia, a man he was of great reputation, whom I had formerly seen in that war, and one of the highest fame, both for his skill in war, his strength of body, and the courage of his soul. This man, seeing the Romans giving ground, and ill a sad condition, for he stood by Titus at the tower of Antonia, leaped out, and of himself alone put the Jews to flight, when they were already conquerors, and made them retire as far as the corner of the inner court of the temple. From him the multitude fled away in crowds, as supposing that neither his strength nor his violent attacks could be those of a mere man. Accordingly, he rushed through the midst of the Jews, as they were dispersed all abroad, and killed those that he caught. Nor, indeed, was there any sight that appeared more wonderful in the eyes of Caesar, or more terrible to others, than this. However, he was himself pursued by fate, which is not at all possible that he, who was but a mortal man, should escape. For as he had shoes all full of thick and sharp nails, as had every one of the other soldiers, so when he ran on the pavement of the temple, he slipped and fell down upon his back with a very great noise, which was made by his armor. Footnote. No wonder that this Julian, who had so many nails in his shoes, slipped upon the pavement of the temple, which was smooth, and laid with marble of different colors. End footnote. This made those that were running away to turn back, whereupon those Romans that were in the tower of Antonia set up a great shout, as they were in fear for the man. But the Jews got about him in crowds, and struck at him with their spears and with their swords on all sides. Now he received a great many of the strokes of these iron weapons upon his shield, and often attempted to get up again, but was thrown down by those that struck at him. Yet did he, as he lay along, stab many of them with his sword. Nor was he soon killed, as being covered with his helmet and his breastplate and all those parts of the body where he might be mortally wounded. He also pulled his neck close to his body, till all his other limbs were shattered, and nobody durst come to defend him, and then he yielded to his fate. Now Caesar was deeply affected on account of this man of so great fortitude, and especially as he was killed in the sight of so many people. He was desirous himself to come to his assistance, but the place would not give him leave, while such as could have done it were too much terrified to attempt it. Thus when Julian had struggled with death a great while, and had let but few of those that had given him his mortal wound go off unhurt, he had at last his throat cut, though not without some difficulty, and left behind him a very great fame, not only among the Romans and with Caesar himself, but among his enemies also. Then did the Jews catch up his dead body, and put the Romans to flight again, and shut them up in the tower of Antonia. Now those that most signalized themselves, and fought most zealously in this battle of the Jewish side, were one Alexus and Glyphtheus, of John's party, and of Simon's party were Malachias, and Judas the son of Myrto, and James the son of Sosas, the commander of the Idumeans, and of the Zealots two brethren, Simon and Judas, the sons of Jairus. End of Book 6, Chapter 1.
Book 7, Chapter 8, Part 1 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. The Wars of the Jews by Flavius Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Book 7, Chapter 8, Part 1. Concerning Masada and those Sicarii who kept it, and how Silva betook himself to form the siege of that citadel, Eleazar's speeches to the besieged. When Bassus was dead in Judea, Flavius Silva succeeded him as procurator there, who, when he saw that all the rest of the country was subdued in this war, and that there was but one only stronghold that was still in rebellion, he got all his army together that lay in different places, and made an expedition against it. This fortress was called Masada. It was one Eleazar, a potent man, and the commander of these Sicarii, that had seized upon it. He was a descendant from that Judas who had persuaded abundance of the Jews, as we have formerly related, not to submit to the taxation when Cyrenius was sent into Judea to make one, for then it was that the Sicarii got together against those that were willing to submit to the Romans, and treated them in all respects as if they had been their enemies, both by plundering them of what they had, by driving away their cattle, and by setting fire to their houses. For they said that they differed not at all from foreigners, by betraying, in so cowardly a manner, that freedom which Jews thought worthy to be contended for to the utmost, and by owning that they preferred slavery under the Romans before such a contention. Now this was in reality no better than a pretense and a cloak for the barbarity which was made use of by them, and to color over their own avarice, which they afterwards made evident by their own actions. For those that were partners with them in their rebellion joined also with them in their war against the Romans, and went further lengths with them in their impudent undertakings against them. And when they were again convicted of dissembling in such their pretenses, they still more abused those that justly reproached them for their wickedness. And indeed that was a time most fertile in all manner of wicked practices, insomuch that no kind of evil deeds were then left undone. Nor could any one so much as devise any bad thing that was new, so deeply were they all infected, and strove with one another in their single capacity and in their communities, who should run the greatest lengths in impiety towards God, and in unjust actions towards their neighbors, the men of power oppressing the multitude, and the multitude earnestly laboring to destroy the men of power. The one part were desirous of tyrannizing over others, and the rest of offering violence to others, and of plundering such as were richer than themselves. They were the Sicarii who first began these transgressions, and first became barbarous toward those allied to them, and left no words of reproach unsaid, and no works of perdition untried, in order to destroy those whom their contrivances affected. Yet did John demonstrate by his actions that these Sicarii were more moderate than he was himself, for he not only slew all such as gave him good counsel to do what was right, but treated them worst of all, as the most bitter enemies that he had among all the citizens. Nay, he filled his entire country with 10,000 instances of wickedness, such as a man who was already hardened sufficiently in his impiety towards God would naturally do. For the food was unlawful that was set upon his table, and he rejected those purifications that the law of his country had ordained, so that it was no longer a wonder if he, who was so mad in his impiety towards God, did not observe any rules of gentleness and common affection towards men. Again, therefore, what mischief was there which Simon the son of Gioras did not do? Or what kind of abuses did he abstain from as to those very free men who had set him up for a tyrant? What friendship or kindred were there that did not make him more bold in his daily murders? For they looked upon the doing of mischief to strangers only as a work beneath their courage, but thought their barbarity towards their nearest relations would be a glorious demonstration thereof. The Idumeans also strove with these men who should be guilty of the greatest madness, for they all, vile wretches as they were, cut the throats of the high priests, that so no part of a religious regard to God might be preserved. They thence proceeded to destroy utterly the least remains of a political government, and introduced the most complete scene of iniquity in all instances that were practicable. Under which scene that sort of people that were called zealots grew up, and who indeed corresponded to the name, for they imitated every wicked work. Nor, if their memory suggested any evil thing that had formerly been done, did they avoid zealously to pursue the same. and although they gave themselves that name from their zeal for what was good, yet did it agree to them only by way of irony, on account of those they had unjustly treated by their wild and brutish disposition, or as thinking the greatest mischiefs to be the greatest good. Accordingly, they all met with such ends as God deservedly brought upon them in way of punishment. For all such miseries have been sent upon them as man's nature is capable of undergoing, till the utmost period of their lives, and till death came upon them in various ways of torment. Yet might one say justly that they suffered less than they had done, because it was impossible they could be punished according to their deserving. But to make a lamentation according to the deserts of those who fell under these men's barbarity, this is not a proper place for it. I therefore now return again to the remaining part of the present narration. For now it was that the Roman general came, and led his army against Eleazar and those Sicarii who held the fortress Masada together with him, and for the whole country adjoining he presently gained it, and put garrisons into the most proper places of it. He also built a wall quite round the entire fortress, that none of the besieged might easily escape. He also set his men to guard the several parts of it. He also pitched his camp in such an agreeable place as he had chosen for the siege, and at which place the rock belonging to the fortress did make the nearest approach to the neighboring mountain, which yet was a place of difficulty for getting plenty of provisions, for it was not only food that was to be brought from a great distance to the army, and this with a great deal of pain to those Jews who were appointed for that purpose, but water was also to be brought to the camp, because the place afforded no fountain that was near it. When therefore Silva had ordered these affairs beforehand, he fell to besieging the place, which siege was likely to stand in need of a great deal of skill and pains, by reason of the strength of the fortress, the nature of which I will now describe. There was a rock, not small in circumference, and very high. It was encompassed with valleys of such vast depth downward that the eye could not reach their bottoms. They were abrupt, and such as no animal could walk upon, excepting at two places of the rock, where it subsides, in order to afford a passage for ascent, though not without difficulty. Now, of the ways that lead to it, one is that from the lake Asphaltiris, towards the sun rising, and another on the west, where the ascent is easier. The one of these ways is called the serpent, as resembling that animal in its narrowness and its perpetual windings, for it is broken off at the prominent precipices of the rock, and returns frequently into itself, and lengthening again by little and little, hath much ado to proceed forward, and he that would walk along it must first go on one leg, and then on the other. There is also nothing but destruction in case your feet slip, for on each side there is a vastly deep chasm and precipice, sufficient to quell the courage of every body by the terror it infuses into the mind. When, therefore, a man hath gone along this way for 30 furlongs, the rest is the top of the hill, not ending at a small point, but it is no other than a plain upon the highest part of the mountain. Upon this top of the hill, Jonathan the high priest first of all built a fortress, and called it Masada, after which the rebuilding of this place employed the care of King Herod to a great degree. He also built a wall round about the entire top of the hill, 7 furlongs long. It was composed of white stone, its height was 12, and its breadth 8 cubits. There were also erected upon that wall 38 towers, each of them 50 cubits high, out of which you might pass into lesser edifices, which were built on the inside, round the entire wall. For the king reserved the top of the hill, which was of a fat soil, and better mould than any valley, for agriculture, that such as committed themselves to this fortress for their preservation might not even there be quite destitute of food, in case they should ever be in want of it from abroad. Moreover, he built a palace therein at the western ascent. It was within and beneath the walls of the citadel, but inclined to its north side. Now the wall of this palace was very high and strong, and had at its four corners towers 60 cubits high. the furniture also of the edifices, and of the cloisters, and of the baths, was of great variety and very costly. And these buildings were supported by pillars of single stones on every side. The walls, and also the floors of the edifices, were paved with stones of several colors. He also had cut many and great pits, as reservoirs for water, out of the rocks, and at every one of the places that were inhabited, both above and round about the palace, and before the wall. And by this contrivance he endeavored to have water for several uses, as if there had been fountains there. Here was also a road digged from the palace, and leading to the very top of the mountain, which yet could not be seen by such as were without the walls, nor indeed could enemies easily make use of the plain roads, for the road on the east side, as we have already taken notice, could not be walked upon by reason of its nature, and for the western road he built a large tower at its narrowest place, at no less a distance from the top of the hill than 1,000 cubits, which tower could not possibly be passed by, nor could it be easily taken. Nor indeed could those that walked along it without any fear, such was its contrivance, easily get to the end of it. And after such a manner was this citadel fortified, both by nature and by the hands of men, in order to frustrate the attacks of enemies. As for the furniture that was within this fortress, it was still more wonderful on account of its splendor and long continuance. For here was laid up corn in large quantities, and such as would subsist men for a long time. Here was also wine and oil in abundance, with all kinds of pulse and dates heaped up together, all which Eleazar found there, when he and his Sicarii got possession of the fortress by treachery. These fruits were also fresh and full ripe, and no way inferior to such fruits newly laid in, although they were little short of 100 years from the laying in these provisions by Herod, till the place was taken by the Romans. Nay, indeed, when the Romans got possession of those fruits that were left, they found them not corrupted all that while, nor should we be mistaken if we supposed that the air was here the cause of their enduring so long, this fortress being so high, and so free from the mixture of all terrain and muddy particles of matter. There was also found here a large quantity of all sorts of weapons of war, which had been treasured up by that king, and were sufficient for 10,000 men. There was cast iron, and brass, and tin, which show that he had taken much pains to have all things here ready for the greatest occasions. For the report goes how Herod thus prepared this fortress on his own account, as a refuge against two kinds of danger, the one for fear of the multitude of the Jews, lest they should depose him, and restore their former kings to the government. The other danger was greater and more terrible, which arose from Cleopatra, queen of Egypt, who did not conceal her intentions, but spoke often to Antony, and desired him to cut off Herod, and entreated him to bestow the kingdom of Judea upon her. And certainly it is a great wonder that Antony did never comply with her commands in this point, as he was so miserably enslaved to his passion for her. Nor should any one have been surprised if she had been gratified in such her request. So the fear of these dangers made Herod rebuild Masada, and thereby leave it for the finishing stroke of the Romans in this Jewish war. Since, therefore, the Roman commander Silva had now built a wall on the outside, round about this whole place, as we have said already, and had thereby made a most accurate provision to prevent any one of the besieged running away, he undertook the siege itself, though he found but one single place that would admit of the banks he was to raise. For behind that tower which secured the road that led to the palace, and to the top of the hill from the west, there was a certain eminency of the rock, very broad and very prominent, but 300 cubits beneath the highest part of Masada. It was called the White Promontory. Accordingly he got upon that part of the rock, and ordered the army to bring earth. And when they fell to that work with alacrity, and abundance of them together, the bank was raised, and became solid for 200 cubits in height. Yet was not this bank thought sufficiently high for the use of the engines that were to be set upon it, but still another elevated work of great stones compacted together was raised upon that bank. This was 50 cubits, both in breadth and height. The other machines that were now got ready were like to those that had been first devised by Vespasian, and afterwards by Titus, for sieges. There was also a tower made of the height of 60 cubits, and all over plated with iron, out of which the Romans threw darts and stones from the engines, and soon made those that fought from the walls of the place to retire, and would not let them lift up their heads above the works. At the same time Silva ordered that great battering ram which he had made to be brought thither, and to be set against the wall, and to make frequent batteries against it, which with some difficulty broke down a part of the wall, and quite overthrew it. However, the Sicarii made haste, and presently built another wall within that, which should not be liable to the same misfortune from the machines with the other. It was made soft and yielding, and so was capable of avoiding the terrible blows that affected the other. It was framed after the following manner. They laid together great beams of wood lengthways, one close to the end of another, and the same way in which they were cut. There were two of these rows parallel to one another, and laid at such a distance from each other as the breadth of the wall required, and earth was put into the space between those rows. Now that the earth might not fall away upon the elevation of this bank to a greater height, they further laid other beams over across them, and thereby bound those beams together that lay lengthways. This work of theirs was like a real edifice, and when the machines were applied, the blows were weakened by its yielding, and as the materials by such concussion were shaken closer together, the pile by that means became firmer than before. When Silva saw this, he thought it best to endeavor the taking of this wall by setting fire to it. So he gave orders that the soldiers should throw a great number of burning torches upon it. Accordingly, as it was chiefly made of wood, it soon took fire. And when it was once set on fire, its hollowness made that fire spread to a mighty flame. Now, at the very beginning of this fire, a north wind that then blew proved terrible to the Romans, for by bringing the flame downward, it drove it upon them, and they were almost in despair of success, as fearing their machines would be burnt. But after this, on a sudden the wind changed into the south, as if it were done by divine providence, and blew strongly the contrary way, and carried the flame, and drove it against the wall, which was now on fire through its entire thickness. So the Romans, having now assistance from God, returned to their camp with joy, and resolved to attack their enemies the very next day, on which occasion they set their watch more carefully that night, lest any of the Jews should run away from them without being discovered. End of Book 7, Chapter 8, Part 1. Book 7, Chapter 8, Part 2 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. The Wars of the Jews by Flavius Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Chapter 8, Part 2. However, neither did Eleazar once think of flying away, nor would he permit any one else to do so. But when he saw their wall burned down by the fire, and could devise no other way of escaping, or room for their further courage, and setting before their eyes what the Romans would do to them, their children, and their wives, if they got them into their power, he consulted about having them all slain. Now as he judged this to be the best thing they could do in their present circumstances, he gathered the most courageous of his companions together, and encouraged them to take that course by a speech which he made to them in the manner following. Since we, long ago, my generous friends, resolved never to be servants to the Romans, nor to any other than to God himself, who alone is the true and just Lord of mankind, the time is now come that obliges us to make that resolution true in practice, And let us not at this time bring a reproach upon ourselves for self-contradiction, while we formerly would not undergo slavery, though it were then without danger, but must now, together with slavery, choose such punishments also as are intolerable. I mean this upon the supposition that the Romans once reduce us under their power while we are alive. We were the very first that revolted from them, and we are the last that fight against them. And I cannot but esteem it as a favor that God hath granted us, that it is still in our power to die bravely and in a state of freedom, which hath not been the case of others, who were conquered unexpectedly. It is very plain that we shall be taken within a day's time, but it is still an eligible thing to die after a glorious manner, together with our dearest friends. This is what our enemies themselves cannot by any means hinder, although they be very desirous to take us alive. Nor can we propose to ourselves any more to fight them and beat them. It had been proper indeed for us to have conjectured at the purpose of God much sooner, and at the very first, when we were so desirous of defending our liberty, and when we received such sore treatment from one another, and worse treatment from our enemies, and to have been sensible that the same God, who had of old taken the Jewish nation into his favor, had now condemned them to destruction. For had he either continued favorable, or been but in a lesser degree displeased with us, he had not overlooked the destruction of so many men, or delivered his most holy city to be burnt and demolished by our enemies. To be sure, we weakly hoped to have preserved ourselves, and ourselves alone, still in a state of freedom, as if we had been guilty of no sins ourselves against God, nor been partners with those of others. We also taught other men to preserve their liberty. Wherefore, consider how God hath convinced us that our hopes were in vain, by bringing such distress upon us in the desperate state we are now in, and which is beyond all our expectations. For the nature of this fortress, which was in itself unconquerable, hath not proved a means of our deliverance, and even while we have still great abundance of food, and a great quantity of arms, and other necessaries more than we want, we are openly deprived by God himself of all hope of deliverance. For that fire which was driven upon our enemies did not of its own accord turn back upon the wall which we had built. This was the effect of God's anger against us for our manifold sins, which we have been guilty of in a most insolent and extravagant manner with regard to our own countrymen, the punishments of which let us not receive from the Romans, but from God himself, as executed by our own hands. For these will be more moderate than the other. Let our wives die before they are abused, and our children before they have tasted of slavery, and after we have slain them, let us bestow that glorious benefit upon one another mutually, and preserve ourselves in freedom, as an excellent funeral monument for us. But first let us destroy our money and the fortress by fire, for I am well assured that this will be a great grief to the Romans, that they shall not be able to seize upon our bodies, and shall fall of our wealth also. And let us spare nothing but our provisions, for they will be a testimonial when we are dead that we were not subdued for want of necessaries, but that, according to our original resolution, we have preferred death before slavery. This was Eleazar's speech to them. Yet did not the opinions of all the auditors acquiesce therein, but although some of them were very zealous to put his advice in practice, and were in a manner filled with pleasure at it, and thought death to be a good thing, yet had those that were most effeminate a commiseration for their wives and families. And when these men were especially moved by the prospect of their own certain death, they looked wistfully at one another, and by the tears that were in their eyes declared their dissent from his opinion. When Eleazar saw these people in such fear, and that their souls were dejected at so prodigious a proposal, he was afraid lest perhaps these effeminate persons should, by their lamentations and tears, enfeeble those that heard what he had said courageously. So he did not leave off exhorting them, but stirred up himself, and recollecting proper arguments for raising their courage, he undertook to speak more briskly and fully to them, and that concerning the immortality of the soul. So he made a lamentable groan, and fixing his eyes intently on those that wept, he spake thus: Truly, I was greatly mistaken when I thought to be assisting to brave men who struggled hard for their liberty, and to such as were resolved either to live with honor or else to die. But I find that you are such people as are no better than others, either in virtue or in courage, and are afraid of dying, though you be delivered thereby from the greatest miseries, while you ought to make no delay in this matter, nor to await any one to give you good advice. For the laws of our country, and of God himself, have from ancient times, and as soon as ever we could use our reason, continually taught us, and our forefathers have corroborated the same doctrine by their actions, and by their bravery of mind, that it is life that is a calamity to men, and not death, for this last affords our souls their liberty, and sends them by a removal into their own place of purity, where they are to be insensible of all sorts of misery. For while souls are tied down to a mortal body, they are partakers of its miseries. And really, to speak the truth, they are themselves dead, for the union of what is divine to what is mortal is disagreeable. It is true, the power of the soul is great, even when it is imprisoned in a mortal body, for by moving it after a way that is invisible, it makes the body a sensible instrument, and causes it to advance further in its actions than mortal nature could otherwise do. However, when it is freed from that weight which draws it down to the earth and is connected with it, it obtains its own proper place, and does then become a partaker of that blessed power and those abilities which are then every way incapable of being hindered in their operations. It continues invisible indeed to the eyes of men, as does God himself, for certainly it is not itself seen while it is in the body, for it is there after an invisible manner, and when it is freed from it, it is still not seen. It is this soul which hath one nature, and that an incorruptible one also, but yet it is the cause of the change that is made in the body. For whatsoever it be which the soul touches, that lives and flourishes, and from whatsoever it is removed, that withers away and dies. Such a degree is there in it of immortality. Let me produce the state of sleep as a most evident demonstration of the truth of what I say, wherein souls, when the body does not distract them, have the sweetest rest depending on themselves and conversing with God by their alliance to him. They then go everywhere, and foretell many futurities beforehand. And why are we afraid of death, while we are pleased with the rest that we have in sleep? And how absurd a thing is it to pursue after liberty while we are alive, and yet to envy it to ourselves where it will be eternal? We, therefore, who have been brought up in a discipline of our own, ought to become an example to others of our readiness to die. Yet, if we do stand in need of foreigners to support us in this matter, let us regard those Indians who profess the exercise of philosophy, for these good men do but unwillingly undergo the time of life, and look upon it as a necessary servitude, and make haste to let their souls loose from their bodies. Nay, when no misfortune presses them to it, nor drives them upon it, these have such a desire of a life of immortality that they tell other men beforehand that they are about to depart, and nobody hinders them, but every one thinks them happy men, and gives them letters to be carried to their familiar friends that are dead, so firmly and certainly do they believe that souls converse with one another in the other world. So when these men have heard all such commands that were given them, they deliver their body to the fire, and in order to their getting their soul a separation from the body in the greatest purity, they die in the midst of hymns of commendations made to them, for their dearest friends conduct them to their death more readily than do any of the rest of mankind conduct their fellow citizens when they are going a very long journey, who at the same time weep on their own account, but look upon the others as happy persons, as so soon to be made partakers of the immortal order of beings. Are not we, therefore, ashamed to have lower notions than the Indians, and by our own cowardice to lay a base reproach upon the laws of our country, which are so much desired and imitated by all mankind? But put the case that we had been brought up under another persuasion, and taught that life is the greatest good which men are capable of, and that death is a calamity. However, the circumstances we are now in ought to be an inducement to us to bear such calamity courageously, since it is by the will of God, and by necessity, that we are to die. For it now appears that God hath made such a decree against the whole Jewish nation that we are to be deprived of this life which he knew we would not make a due use of. For do not you ascribe the occasion of our present condition to yourselves, nor think the Romans are the true occasion that this war we have had with them is become so destructive to us all? These things have not come to pass by their power, but a more powerful cause hath intervened, and made us afford them an occasion of their appearing to be conquerors over us. What Roman weapons, I pray you, were those by which the Jews at Caesarea were slain? On the contrary, when they were no way disposed to rebel, but were all the while keeping their seventh-day festival, and did not so much as lift up their hands against the citizens of Caesarea, yet did those citizens run upon them in great crowds and cut their throats, and the throats of their wives and children, and this without any regard to the Romans themselves, who never took us for their enemies till we revolted from them. But some may be ready to say that truly the people of Caesarea had always a quarrel against those that lived among them, and that when an opportunity offered itself, they only satisfied the old rancor they had against them. What then shall we say to those of Scythopolis, who ventured to wage war with us on account of the Greeks? Nor did they do it by way of revenge upon the Romans, when they acted in concert with our countrymen. Wherefore you see how little our good will and fidelity to them profited us, while they were slain, they and their whole families, after the most inhuman manner, which was all the requital that was made them for the assistance they had afforded the others. For that very same destruction which they had prevented from falling upon the others did they suffer themselves from them, as if they had been ready to be the actors against them. It would be too long for me to speak at this time of every destruction brought upon us, for you cannot but know that there was not any one Syrian city which did not slay their Jewish inhabitants, and were not more bitter enemies to us than were the Romans themselves. Nay, even those of Damascus, when they were able to allege no tolerable pretense against us, filled their city with the most barbarous slaughters of our people, and cut the throats of 18,000 Jews with their wives and children. And as to the multitude of those that were slain in Egypt, and that with torments also, we have been informed they were more than 60,000, those indeed being in a foreign country, and so naturally meeting with nothing to oppose against their enemies, were killed in the manner forementioned. As for all those of us who have waged war against the Romans in our own country, had we not sufficient reason to have sure hopes of victory? For we had arms, and walls, and fortresses so prepared as not to be easily taken, and courage not to be moved by any dangers in the cause of liberty, which encouraged us all to revolt from the Romans. But then these advantages sufficed us but for a short time, and only raised our hopes, while they really appeared to be the origin of our miseries. For all we had hath been taken from us, and all hath fallen under our enemies, as if these advantages were only to render their victory over us the more glorious, and were not disposed for the preservation of those by whom these preparations were made. And as for those that are already dead in the war, it is reasonable that we should esteem them blessed, for they are dead in defending, and not in betraying their liberty. But as to the multitude of those that are now under the Romans, who would not pity their condition, and who would not make haste to die before he would suffer the same miseries with them? Some of them have been put upon the rack, and tortured with fire and whippings, and so died. Some have been half devoured by wild beasts, and yet have been reserved alive to be devoured by them a second time, in order to afford laughter and sport to our enemies. And such of those as are alive still are to be looked on as the most miserable, who, being so desirous of death, could not come at it. And where is now that great city, the metropolis of the Jewish nation, which was fortified by so many walls round about, which had so many fortresses and large towers to defend it, which could hardly contain the instruments prepared for the war, and which had so many 10,000s of men to fight for it? Where is this city that was believed to have God himself inhabiting therein? It is now demolished to the very foundations, and hath nothing but that monument of it preserved, I mean the camp of those that hath destroyed it, which still dwells upon its ruins. Some unfortunate old men also lie upon the ashes of the temple, and a few women are there preserved alive by the enemy, for our bitter shame and reproach. Now who is there that revolves these things in his mind, and yet is able to bear the sight of the sun, though he might live out of danger? Who is there so much his country's enemy, or so unmanly, and so desirous of living, as not to repent that he is still alive? And I cannot but wish that we had all died before we had seen that holy city demolished by the hands of our enemies, or the foundations of our holy temple dug up after so profane a manner. But since we had a generous hope that deluded us, as if we might perhaps have been able to avenge ourselves on our enemies on that account, though it be now become vanity, and hath left us alone in this distress, let us make haste to die bravely. Let us pity ourselves, our children, and our wives, while it is in our own power to show pity to them. For we were born to die, as well as those were whom we have begotten, nor is it in the power of the most happy of our race to avoid it. But for abuses and slavery, and the sight of our wives led away after an ignominious manner with their children, these are not such evils as are natural and necessary among men, although such as do not prefer death before those miseries, when it is in their power so to do, must undergo even them, on account of their own cowardice. We revolted from the Romans with great pretensions to courage, and when, at the very last, they invited us to preserve ourselves, we would not comply with them. Who will not, therefore, believe that they will certainly be in a rage at us, in case they can take us alive? Miserable will then be the young men who will be strong enough in their bodies to sustain many torments. Miserable also will be those of elder years, who will not be able to bear those calamities which young men might sustain. One man will be obliged to hear the voice of his son implore help of his father when his hands are bound. But certainly our hands are still at liberty, and have a sword in them. Let them then be subservient to us in our glorious design. Let us die before we become slaves under our enemies, and let us go out of the world, together with our children and our wives, in a state of freedom. This it is that our laws command us to do. This it is that our wives and children crave at our hands. Nay, God himself hath brought this necessity upon us, while the Romans desire the contrary, and are afraid lest any of us should die before we are taken. Let us therefore make haste, and instead of affording them so much pleasure as they hope for in getting us under their power, let us leave them an example which shall at once cause their astonishment at our death, and their admiration of our hardiness therein. End of Book 7, Chapter 8, Part 2. Book 7, Chapters 9 through 11 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. The Wars of the Jews by Flavius Josephus, translated by William Whiston, Chapters 9 through 11. Chapter 9. How the people that were in the fortress were prevailed on by the words of Eleazar, two women and five children only accepted, and all submitted to be killed by one another. Now as Eleazar was proceeding on in this exhortation, they all cut him off short, and made haste to do the work, as full of an unconquerable ardor of mind, and moved with a demoniacal fury. So they went their ways, as one still endeavouring to be before another, and as thinking that this eagerness would be a demonstration of their courage and good conduct, if they could avoid appearing in the last class. So great was the zeal they were in to slay their wives and their children, and themselves also. Nor indeed, when they came to the work itself, did their courage fail them, as one might imagine it would have done, but they then held fast the same resolution, without wavering, which they had upon the hearing of Eleazar's speech, while yet every one of them still retained the natural passion of love to themselves and their families, because the reasoning they went upon appeared to them to be very just, even with regard to those that were dearest to them. For the husbands tenderly embraced their wives, and took their children into their arms, and gave the longest parting kisses to them, with tears in their eyes. Yet at the same time did they complete what they had resolved on, as if they had been executed by the hands of strangers, and they had nothing else for their comfort but the necessity they were in of doing this execution, to avoid that prospect they had of the miseries they were to suffer from their enemies. Nor was there at length any one of these men found that scrupled to act their part in this terrible execution, but every one of them dispatched his dearest relations. Miserable men indeed were they, whose distress forced them to slay their own wives and children with their own hands, as the lightest of those evils that were before them. So they, being not able to bear the grief they were under for what they had done any longer, and esteeming it an injury to those they had slain, to live even the shortest space of time after them, they presently laid all they had upon a heap, and set fire to it. They then chose 10 men by lot out of them to slay all the rest, every one of whom laid himself down by his wife and children on the ground, and threw his arms about them, and they offered their necks to the stroke of those who by lot executed that melancholy office. And when these 10 had without fear slain them all, they made the same rule for casting lots for themselves, that he whose lot it was should first kill the other 9, and after all should kill himself. Accordingly, all these had courage sufficient to be no way behind one another in doing or suffering. So, for a conclusion, the 9 offered their necks to the executioner, and he who was the last of all took a view of all the other bodies, lest perchance some or other among so many that were slain should want his assistance to be quite dispatched. And when he perceived that they were all slain, he set fire to the palace, and with the great force of his hand ran his sword entirely through himself, and fell down dead near to his own relations. So these people died with this intention, that they would not leave so much as one soul among them all alive to be subject to the Romans. Yet there was an ancient woman, and another who was of kin to Eleazar, and superior to most women in prudence and learning, with 5 children, who had concealed themselves in caverns underground, and had carried water thither for their drink, and were hidden there when the rest were intent upon the slaughter of one another. Those others were 960 in number, the women and children being withal included in that computation. This calamitous slaughter was made on the 15th day of the month Xanthicus. Now for the Romans, they expected that they should be fought in the morning, when accordingly they put on their armor, and laid bridges of planks upon their ladders from their banks, to make an assault upon the fortress, which they did, but saw nobody as an enemy, but a terrible solitude on every side, with a fire within the place, as well as a perfect silence. So they were at a loss to guess at what had happened. At length they made a shout, as if it had been at a blow given by the battering-ram, to try whether they could bring any one out that was within. The women heard this noise, and came out of their underground cavern, and informed the Romans what had been done as it was done, and the second of them clearly described all both what was said and what was done, and this manner of it. Yet did they not easily give their attention to such a desperate undertaking, and did not believe it could be as they said. They also attempted to put the fire out, and quickly cutting themselves away through it, they came within the palace, and so met with the multitude of the slain, but could take no pleasure in the fact, though it were done to their enemies. Nor could they do other than wonder at the courage of their resolution, and the immovable contempt of death which so great a number of them had shown, when they went through with such an action as that was.
Chapter 10.
that many of the Sicarii fled to Alexandria also, and what dangers they were in there, on which account that temple which had formerly been built by Onias the high priest was destroyed. When Masada was thus taken, the general left a garrison in the fortress to keep it, and he himself went away to Caesarea. For there were now no enemies left in the country, but it was all overthrown by so long a war. Yet did this war afford disturbances and dangerous disorders even in places very far remote from Judea. For still it came to pass that many Jews were slain at Alexandria in Egypt. For as many of the Sicarii as were able to fly thither, out of the seditious wars in Judea, were not content to have saved themselves, but must needs be undertaking to make new disturbances, and persuaded many of those that entertained them to assert their liberty, to esteem the Romans to be no better than themselves, and to look upon God as their only Lord and Master. But when part of the Jews of reputation opposed them, they slew some of them, and with the others they were very pressing in their exhortations to revolt from the Romans. But when the principal men of the Senate saw what madness they were come to, they thought it no longer safe for themselves to overlook them. So they got all the Jews together to an assembly, and accused the madness of the Sicarii, and demonstrated that they had been the authors of all the evils that had come upon them. They said also that these men, now that they were run away from Judea, having no sure hope of escaping, because as soon as ever they shall be known, they will soon be destroyed by the Romans, they come hither and fill us full of those calamities which belong to them, while we have not been partakers with them in any of their sins. Accordingly, they exhorted the multitude to have a care, lest they should be brought to destruction by their means, and to make their apology to the Romans for what had been done by delivering these men up to them, who being thus apprised of the greatness of the danger they were in, complied with what was proposed, and ran with great violence upon the Sicarii, and seized upon them. And indeed 600 of them were caught immediately. But as to all those that fled into Egypt and to the Egyptian Thebes, it was not long ere they were caught also and brought back, whose courage, or whether we ought to call it madness, or hardiness in their opinions, every body was amazed at. For when all sorts of torments and vexations of their bodies that could be devised were made use of to them, they could not get any one of them to comply so far as to confess, or seem to confess, that Caesar was their lord. But they preserved their own opinion, in spite of all the distress they were brought to, as if they received these torments and the fire itself with bodies insensible of pain, and with a soul that in a manner rejoiced under them. But what was most of all astonishing to the beholders was the courage of the children, for not one of these children was so far overcome by these torments as to name Caesar for their lord. So far does the strength of the courage of the soul prevail over the weakness of the body. Now Lupus did then govern Alexandria, who presently sent Caesar word of this commotion, who having in suspicion the restless temper of the Jews for innovation, and being afraid lest they should get together again, and persuade some others to join with them, gave orders to Lupus to demolish that Jewish temple which was in the region called Onion, and was in Egypt, which was built and had its denomination from the occasion following. Onias, the son of Simon, one of the Jewish high priests, fled from Antiochus, the king of Syria, when he made war with the Jews and came to Alexandria, and as Ptolemy received him very kindly, on account of hatred to Antiochus, he assured him that if he would comply with his proposal, he would bring all the Jews to his assistance. And when the king agreed to do it, so far as he was able, he desired him to give him leave to build a temple somewhere in Egypt, and to worship God according to the customs of his own country, for that the Jews would then be so much readier to fight against Antiochus who had laid waste the temple at Jerusalem, and that they would then come to him with greater good will, and that, by granting them liberty of conscience, very many of them would come over to him. So Ptolemy complied with his proposals, and gave him a place 180 furlongs distant from Memphis. That nomos was called the nomos of Heliopolis, where Onias built a fortress and a temple, not like to that at Jerusalem, but such as resembled a tower. He built it of large stones to the height of 60 cubits. He made the structure of the altar in imitation of that in our own country, and in like manner adorned with gifts, excepting the make of the candlestick, for he did not make a candlestick, but had a single lamp hammered out of a piece of gold, which illuminated the place with its rays, and which he hung by a chain of gold. But the entire temple was encompassed with a wall of burnt brick, though it had gates of stone. The king also gave him a large country for a revenue in money, that both the priests might have a plentiful provision made for them, and that God might have great abundance of what things were necessary for his worship. Yet did not Onias do this out of a sober disposition, but he had a mind to contend with the Jews at Jerusalem, and could not forget the indignation he had for being banished thence. Accordingly, he thought that by building this temple he should draw away a great number from them to himself. There had been also a certain ancient prediction made by a prophet whose name was Isaiah, about 600 years before, that this temple should be built by a man that was a Jew in Egypt. And this is the history of the building of that temple. And now Lupus, the governor of Alexandria, upon the receipt of Caesar's letter, came to the temple, and carried out of it some of the donations dedicated thereto, and shut up the temple itself. And as Lupus died a little afterward, Paulinus succeeded him. This man left none of those donations there, and threatened the priests severely if they did not bring them all out, nor did he permit any who were desirous of worshipping God there to so much as come near the whole sacred place. But when he had shut up the gates, he made it entirely inaccessible, insomuch that there remained no longer the least footsteps of any divine worship that had been in that place. Now the duration of the time from the building of this temple till it was shut up again was 343 years. Chapter 11. Concerning Jonathan, one of the Sicarii, that stirred up a sedition in Cyrene, and was a false accuser of the innocent. And now did the madness of the Sicarii, like a disease, reach as far as the cities of Cyrene, for one Jonathan, a vile person, and by trade a weaver, came thither and prevailed with no small number of the poorer sort to give ear to him. He also led them into the desert, upon promising them that he would show them signs and apparitions. And as for the other Jews of Cyrene, he concealed his knavery from them, and put tricks upon them. But those of the greatest dignity among them informed Catullus, the governor of the Libyan Pentapolis, of his march into the desert, and of the preparations he had made for it. So he sent out after him both horsemen and footmen, and easily overcame them, because they were unarmed men. Of these many were slain in the fight, but some were taken alive, and brought to Catullus. As for Jonathan, the head of this plot, he fled away at that time. But upon a great and very diligent search, which was made all the country over for him, he was at last taken. And when he was brought to Catullus, he devised a way whereby he both escaped punishment himself, and afforded an occasion to Catullus of doing much mischief. For he falsely accused the richest men among the Jews, and said that they had put him upon what he did. Now Catullus easily admitted of these his calumnies, and aggravated matters greatly, and made tragical exclamations, that he might also be supposed to have had a hand in the finishing of the Jewish war. But what was still harder, he did not only give a too easy belief to his stories, but he taught the Sicarii to accuse men falsely. He bid this Jonathan, therefore, to name one Alexander, a Jew, with whom he had formerly had a quarrel, and openly professed that he hated him. He also got him to name his wife Bernice as concerned with him. These two Catullus ordered to be slain in the first place. Nay, after them he caused all the rich and wealthy Jews to be slain, being no fewer in all than 3,000. This he thought he might do safely, because he confiscated their effects, and added them to Caesar's revenues. Nay, indeed, lest any Jews that lived elsewhere should convict him of his villainy, he extended his false accusations further, and persuaded Jonathan, and certain others that were caught with him, to bring an accusation of attempts for innovation against the Jews that were of the best character both at Alexandria and at Rome. One of these, against whom this treacherous accusation was laid, was Josephus, the writer of these books. However, this plot, thus contrived by Catullus, did not succeed according to his hopes, for though he came himself to Rome, and brought Jonathan and his companions along with him in bonds, and thought that he should have no further inquisition made as to the lies that were forged under his government, or by his means, yet did Vespasian suspect the matter and made an inquiry how far it was true. And when he understood that the accusation laid against the Jews was an unjust one, he cleared them of the crimes charged upon them, and this on account of Titus's concern about the matter, and brought a deserved punishment upon Jonathan, for he was first tormented and then burnt alive. But as to Catullus, the emperors were so gentle to him that he underwent no severe condemnation at this time. Yet was it not long before he fell into a complicated and almost incurable distemper, and died miserably. He was not only afflicted in body, but the distemper in his mind was more heavy upon him than the other, for he was terribly disturbed, and continually cried out that he saw the ghosts of those whom he had slain standing before him. Whereupon he was not able to contain himself, but leaped out of his bed, as if both torments and fire were brought to him. Thus his distemper grew still a great deal worse and worse continually, and his very entrails were so corroded that they fell out of his body, and in that condition he died. Thus he became as great an instance of divine providence as ever was, and demonstrated that God punishes wicked men. And here we shall put an end to this our history, wherein we formerly promised to deliver the same with all accuracy, to such as should be desirous of understanding after what manner this war of the Romans with the Jews was managed. Of which history, how good the style is, must be left to the determination of the readers. But as for its agreement with the facts, I shall not scruple to say, and that boldly, that truth hath been what I have alone aimed at through its entire composition. End of Book 7, Chapters 9 through 11. End of Book 7. End of The Wars of the Jews by Flavius Josephus. Translated by William Whiston.